Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast, where we have folks of all different walks of life share their trials and tribulations, ideas, cerebral chatter, and experiences. We seek to open minds, shed light, and make our modern world feel a little less lonely, realizing that we are all connected, one human experience at a time. I'm your host, Aisha Billy. I would like to thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Aisha.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
I still don't know why you're having me, but I appreciate you having me.
Anyway. I'm having you for a few reasons. One, I love when you talk. Like, I really love what you have to say. Two, you're a human who gives a shit, and I like humans who give a shit. And three, I really appreciate how much on the sleeve your heart really is. Mm-hmm. So we're going to cut into it for the sake of time because we're a little limited today.
Yeah, man. Do what you got to do.
Rick, what does it mean to be an actor?
What does it mean to be an actor? Well, I got into acting at a young age. My brother, Mark, was at the university, where was he? Is it Wayne? Not Wayne State, Western Michigan. I saw him in a play, it just looked like so much fun, you know, seeing all these things happening on stage. And obviously, I was old enough to understand that they were in costumes and they were in a period and they were interpreting a story, you know. And so, for me, it's synonymous with fun because ever since I was a kid, I've been into old movies. And so I also understood that element of it. You know, I saw it on stage and I saw, you know, Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart and, just these amazing actors, Spencer Tracy and all these amazing Ida Lupino and all these amazing actors. I was just into all these old films and it looked so fun to me because you could be anything. You could be good. You could be bad. You could be the hero. You could be the fool. You could be the cop. You could be, you know, the robber. You could be anything. It just seems so limitless. So that's long-windedly what it means to me. It means to be limitless, you know, because you have so many opportunities to just check out, you know, other paths.
You could do stuff that would normally get you in jail, but as an actor, you wouldn't, like, you could play a villain, but
that's
you're not right. Going to jail. You know?
That's right. Yeah. What is it? Tom Waits says in one of his brilliant songs, "You're always innocent when you dream." Right. It's kind of like that. You know, it's that dream. But no matter what you do, no matter how horrible you are, I mean, I played a serial killer in a film, and it was a horrible human, but it was really interesting. It was just interesting to try and wrap your head around the philosophy of somebody who does really horrible things. You know, I mean, there's much more fun parts to play, but it's interesting. It's interesting to look at, and it was based on a true story. So,
wow.
It's also a lesson in psychology. It's a lesson in who we are and what we are as people. You know, because as you know, when we talk about breaking down scripts, you have to understand how the character thinks. You know, not just how Aisha thinks. You have to understand how, you know, the character you're playing thinks, because she thinks differently than you. So to actually wrap your head around a different way of thinking and different reactions and different moods and just different colors that are not yours, I just think it's just intoxicating. And it's just, and when you see people who really get that and people who allow themselves to slip into those different colors, you know, I just think it's amazing.
And you worked a good amount. I didn't know you were on like Dexter and shit.
Yeah, I've done a fair bit of TV. You know, I've done a few films, but most of my experience has been stage and then a lot of television.
What are like some movies that you did?
Well, you know, there was this new Elvis film that came out recently, and I saw it, the Baz Luhrmann film, and I wasn't crazy about the film, but I really liked the guy who played Elvis. I thought he was really good. And I've played Elvis in a film called, the film was entitled Elvis Meets Nixon, me and Bob Gunton of Shawshank fame, of so many other amazing films. he played Richard Nixon and I played Elvis, and it was all about that meeting. And wow. it was a script that seemed so ridiculous, you know, when you read it, because it just seemed so fanciful. But then when I sat down with the writer and I got to know Alan Rosen, the guy who wrote it really well, and he said, look, this is how it happened. This is literally how this stuff went down. And it was just like Elvis's wild adventure. It was so much fun, you know. So I got to play Elvis, and that was a heck of a lot of fun.
That is absolutely incredible. I haven't like crept on you too much. And then before the podcast, I was like, let me look. And I was like, wow, Rick's like really fucking worked. And you were like a hated character on Dexter. Apparently there's still threads about you on Reddit.
Yeah. My kid.
Wait,
yeah.
Can I tell you something?
Go.
So I was like, let me look up a scene of Rick's on Dexter. The only one, or the first one that came up, and I don't think I kept looking after that, was you getting punched in the face.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to end up in Saran wrap, you know, on his table, because that's what, you know, the sketchy people wind up, you know, that's what happens to him on that show. But I didn't break his code. You know, that's what the writers told me. They said no.
How many seasons were you on for?
I was on for about one and a half, almost two seasons.
Do you like work? Did you like working more in TV or more on film?
I like working in whatever medium. So film is kind of fun because you get more time to sort of figure stuff out. TV, you know, you're working on a show in 8 days, and you know, they're, especially when you're a guest star, they just got to get their day. So you move at a pretty furious pace. I mean, there are still some slow days, but it's there. There's just more creative time, I think, with movies. But it's fun, you know. And everybody on Dexter, you know, Michael Hall and everybody, they were just great. They're just really nice people, and I could see why they had success, because they had just a lot of positive energy. The producers, the writers, it was a really cool place to work.
So what do you think is like the underlying thread of success?
A little bit of luck, but definitely determination and discipline. You have to work. You know, I was talking to some young actors today when we were talking about outreach, you and I earlier. And I was explaining to them how important it is to just get yourself in a class and just to keep working and working and working, because this is a confidence game. So ultimately you have to feel 7 feet tall, and the only way you feel 7 feet tall is by continuing to get up on stage and interpreting different work, you know, and breaking down different characters and just putting your ass out there and seeing what happens. And at some point you get into a comfortable place where you're listening and you're connected and it works.
I had a friend on a previous season. His name's Tally Sessions. He's also an actor. I believe works mainly on Broadway. But anyway, something that he said, he was like, a lot of it is like, how well can you charm a room when you go in? And I found that so interesting, like kind of the confidence that you were talking to. I kind of tied it into that, like how well can you, I guess, be confident or seem like you're confident to the point where people are charmed and believe you. I don't know if you agree.
I agree that you know, that's definitely a part of it. But I think it's more important to go in, you know, when we used to actually go into rooms and audition. Now it's all self-tape type stuff, and I think we'll gravitate back to some live auditions again. But if you delivered, if you showed up and executed your game plan, and you can feel the energy when you've done right by that audition, you've gone in and you've killed it. You know, that to me is more important. You know, because sometimes you go into an audition and you're playing somebody with a heavy emotional burden. And so it's hard to be chirpy and charismatic, you know, when you're carrying that, because you want to go in, you want to plug right into that, you want to deliver that, you know, that emotional weight, you know, a father who's dealing with a dying wife, or I've done that a bunch of times, you know, and stuff like that. So really, the important thing is that you're prepared, and that, you know, your preparation meets the moment, and you just, and it happens.
You said father, and it triggered a curiosity. Were your folks, you've been doing this a while, were your folks supportive of you?
Totally. Yeah, my mom and yeah. I'm one of six kids, and I've had an embarrassingly white bread, you know, very, very good childhood. And you know, my brothers and sisters are amazing and amazingly supportive.
You're from Michigan, right?
From Michigan originally. My dad was a Ford executive for 30 years. So we lived in England for 5 years. We lived in Australia for 5 years till I was about 14.
Wow.
And so I had so many opportunities to be in cool places. And my parents, to all of us, always said, what do you want to do? Well, go do it. You know, they were always like that. They always empowered us. And they were just amazing people. I was really, really blessed.
What was it like to move around that much to places that are so far from each other?
Yeah.
Did you?
Me and my and the rest of my siblings, except for my younger brother, he was always struggling with just having to go to different schools. And I loved different scenery. I loved just culturally the way people talked, the differences in that and in the foods and in the grocery stores, going into a grocery store in London and going to a grocery store in Melbourne or in New Zealand. It's just different, you know, and I've always loved that. It's another great thing about acting. If you're mm-hmm. lucky enough to work, you know, they send you off to all sorts of cool places. I've worked in Italy. I've worked in Canada. I've worked in, you know, I've worked in Australia, and I've worked in a lot of different places. And so it's just great. I think, and especially when you're young, you know, so you get to experience just other people's views of our country, you know, and so you have a better, I think, a more complete view of what America is and what it isn't. You know, we were talking about the American dream, you know, before you started recording, and mm-hmm. and what a crock that can be, especially for people from different countries that come over here thinking it's just a key and a door that they have to open, and then boom, it's all there, you know. And that's why I love plays. You know, you and I met in a scene, a script analysis class, you know, a Golden Boy, and plays like that that kind of turn the American dream on its head. I think that's why so many great playwrights, you know, make that observation a big part of their play.
And how ahead of like his time Clifford Odets was in writing that.
Totally.
Because it's like on the mainstream or more openly that I'm hearing the American dream kind of get really like talked about as a crock of shit is now. Like I haven't heard it being spoken about this much by people who I wouldn't expect it to come from until I would say like maybe after COVID. Yeah. That's when I think I started hearing more, and I was like, I guess that's why I related so much to Clifford Odets, because I've been seeing that since I was so young. And I remember in college, I had a professor. So I studied kinesiology in my undergrad. Mm-hmm. So basically the undergrad of a physical therapist. I was totally in denial about my affinity towards the arts. Senior year of college, had to take a writing intensive. It's just a sidebar. But anyway, there was this professor that my motor behavior professor, her undergrad was actually in writing, and then she wanted to go more into science, but she knew this professor from writing. She was like, he's super hard, but you will love him. He was teaching a film analysis writing intensive, and I was like, I need a writing intensive for my degree. I love film, I love analyzing, even though this guy is hard, let me take it. It was a phenomenal class. Him and I hit it off so well. I think I got like an A+ in his class or something. It was A something. I loved writing about film. That's when I realized I was like, but that was just the beginning. Like I didn't realize until maybe a year or 2 years ago that I was like, yikes, this is what I wanted to do all along. But anyway, I don't even know why I brought my degree.
Well, we were talking about Clifford Odets, and we were talking about...
Yes, my professor. So I had a professor who taught the sociology and psychology of sport, which, by the way, learning soc, psych, or history of sport, I highly recommend for actors, for anybody to really give such an in-depth view of what it means to be a fucking human. Because sports, like... I don't know if you know, but lacrosse was basically a way that Native Americans did war. They would throw balls that were like on fire with nets. And then that became lacrosse. So it's just so fascinating to me. But anyway, she would talk a lot about like the American dream. And I remember I said to her, and I think I was in denial about like how heavy this was weighing in my heart, but I said it to her very casually. And she repeated it in another class. And then I had a student approach me and be like, was she talking about your parents? Because she said Turkey. My mom had said to me, if I knew how hard it was going to be here, I never would have came here. Yeah. I would have just stayed in Turkey. But I think by the time she realized that the American dream was a sham, she had these two kids who were born here, like Turkey's so different. How can she just like take us in and you know, the education here is obviously like praise. So she wanted us to get like an American education and stuff. But I remember when I said that to my professor, I said it so casually, not thinking anything of it. And she literally used that in a lecture as an example about, like, I just didn't recognize the depth of the sham of the American dream and what American imperialism really is. But anyway, I never spoke about these things openly, but in reading Golden Boy, which is about, you know, for the listeners, in case they don't know, it's about a kid of Italian immigrants in New York City in I think the 30s, right?
Yeah, 1937.
And it was written by someone who was a son of Italian immigrants.
Actually, I think Russian immigrants. His father was his father was Russian.
I didn't know that. But, you know, same difference essentially. And not to be like so negative in doomsday, but it really is like so fucking devastating, like realizing how fooled my parents were and all these other people who just were like, exactly, you said it, lock and key, just get there and then things will be great.
Yeah, it's funny because I think about some of these countries that have this reputation for being the happiest country to live in. I think Finland is up there, Norway is up there, Denmark is up there, and I guess depending on what side of the political, you know, fence you're sitting on, you could be accused of being a communist for supporting what those countries provide their people, but they provide them just a good safety net. They provide them education, they provide them health, they provide them a lot of the things that our country just doesn't seem to be very good at providing, you know, without extreme cost, you know, financial cost to people. And so I almost wonder if it shouldn't be the American dream, it should be the Finnish dream or the Norwegian dream or the Danish dream, you know, because they seem, I mean, certainly they're not dealing with 330 million people, 340 million, you know, wherever we're at right now. So it's different. We're talking smaller populations, but I think there's just there's a way that our country could operate a little bit better and a little bit more effectively and efficiently.
And to keep us less in survival mode. That's what's so weird to me. We have like such amazing roads and schools and systems and orders and like, you know, obviously the justice system needs work, but like the ability for due process. I'm like, why are we all in survival mode?
Well, I think it's also... it's also the times that we're currently living in. It's just a very polarized, raw time right now. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and I was talking to my son about this. You know, I was saying that, you know, I've met a lot of young people who have a lot of emotional stress and a lot of emotional issues, you know, and I don't remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, I don't remember all the emotional, you know, stuff that was, you know, weighing down people, you know, and I'm sure that it existed, but I think a lot of it is the expectations and the ideals. And I don't want to say it's all about the American dream, but especially in this town in Los Angeles, people have, you know, have their eyes on a prize that's hard to kind of get to at times. And I think it can be a little bit soul sucking, you know, so I don't know. You know, we've talked about this.
I think the phones have a huge influence on it too. Like the hyper availability of us constantly being available. Or like, man, my friend was talking about her parents and she was like, back in the day when they were just dating, my mom would have a shift at like the grocery store and my dad knew it ended at like 8 o'clock. And then he would come around when it would end. And if he caught her, he did. And if not, he just would catch her the next time. Where now people will be having anxiety attack, like, because we have the phones, we have the hyperavailability, like the texting, are you going to be there? Are you going to this? Are you going to that? Where times were just simpler, like
I before. I totally agree. In social media, I was just listening to, I think, NPR. I can't remember. I'm sure it was NPR. They were talking about how, you know, when Facebook came about, how that, you know, that really affected 2007, 2009, something like that. How it really affected Gen Zers and a lot of younger Americans and the idea of being, you know, attached to social media like people are, you know, shopping for likes and all this other stuff. And it's just our kids have phones in their hands now at really young ages, you know. So it's, you know, I think I told you this in when we were working in script analysis, there was a story my brother sent me about how we collectively in America, because of our addiction to devices, we're losing the ability to actually focus enough to actually read a book, you know, because we're constantly, our streams of attention are just constantly interfered with all these devices and all these
screens. Fractured attention.
Yeah, it's totally fractured. It's just, and that just freaked me out. I thought, you know, so I set about saying, okay, I've got to just keep reading books and just, And it's true. Your mind just wanders, you know, I think.
It's about like uninterrupted time, essentially. That's what I think will help with attention. Tension is a hot topic now. Like, I have a friend who's a psychiatrist. I told you about him, and he's trying to figure out his specialty. He's like, I think I'm going to go into attention studying. It's like a whole thing now. Like, people have a hard time maintaining it, or just like because of the hyperavailability with the phones, or like, how do I put this? Things are becoming shorter and shorter, right? You used to have like a show that you would watch the whole 20 minutes through, the whole 60 minutes through. And now it's like your phone, it's the Instagram reels are like these little films that are just constantly like the punchline. You know, when you watch a whole show or you watch a whole film, there's a buildup and then there's a climax. Where like what I notice with like Instagram reels and TikToks, it's the climax. It's just that. Like, it's just the funniest part, the most exciting part, the most uppity.
Yeah, the result. Part. Just the result. Yeah. Nothing on the setup and how we get there. You know, that's such an American thing. You know, it's like we don't want to take the journey. We just want the freaking, you know, we want the payoff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's super fascinating. I mean, I even feel it like when I'm sitting in a class, like I feel that like addictive desire to be like, did anyone text me? Yada, yada. And it's just like, it's something to be mindful of. My senior year of college, my motor behavior professor told me that the brain scans of babies were different a little bit, because the human brain is adapting to having an object so close to their face all the time.
Ugh.
So the anatomy of brains, like we're already seeing the adaptation. This was in 2017 that you told me this. So 6 years
ago. Well, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, getting back to what I was saying about, you know, this NPR story, they were talking about how kids used to socialize. Kids would make it a point of being amongst other kids now. You know, and now kids are kind of isolated more because they stay, you know, connected to their friends, but, you know, through TikTok and through, you know, Instagram and through Facebook, you know, and these other social, you know, these social conduits, but it's not, there's no connection. You're not there laughing and joking. When I was a kid, you know, we'd go to the beach, you know, and we'd hang out and we were constantly, back then we still hung out at malls and you know, or somebody's house and listening to music. And it was just, and I'm sure
there, or like you go over and you're like, hi, Mrs. Thompson, is Jimmy home? Yeah. And Jimmy's like sitting playing video games. And you're like, Jimmy, you want to go like run around blah, blah, blah. And he's like, where? And you're like, I don't know. And he's like, all right. And you just like run out and
you do
playing.
Stuff and you're talking to people and you're engaged, you know? And again, I don't mean to say that all of, you know, the kids today are just, you know, in self-imposed exile, you know, but to a certain extent, I think some of that's probably true. And when you're not around other people, you tend to you know, really fixate on yourself and fixate on issues that may not even be issues, you know? So when you're out socializing and being amongst other people, I don't think your brain has the time to do that, you know?
So speaking about like the influence it's had, I was listening to the Smart List podcast with Keanu Reeves. He was the guest with Jason Bateman and two other guys. I don't know their names. I'm sorry, guys. But Keanu was saying, am I saying that
Keanu.
Right? Keanu Reeves. Keanu. Keanu was saying, I can't even think about pursuing acting now, because he was like, from what I understand, like they want to see what your Instagram following is,
yeah,
or like what your online following is on social media. And like all the guys on the, obviously Jason Bateman, Keanu's 58. I think Jason's probably in his 50s too. I'm pretty sure the other two guys are in their 40s and 50s. They all agree. They were like, we don't know how the kids now are going for this with like the added layer of what's your following on social media.
Yeah. You know, a couple of years ago, I did a movie. I was, and one of the young actors who was on the show, the reason she got the part was because she had X amount of followers. She had no acting experience. She was charismatic and she was used to being in front of the camera because of what she did, you know, live streaming and doing whatever the hell she was doing online. She had all these followers and stuff, but you know, and she was really sweet and everything, but I just thought that I can't help but think that it would have been better if they had hired an actor for that part, you know, instead of somebody who was just sort of a, you know, somebody who had, you know, a bunch of followers, you know, based on, you know, whatever social media outlet it was that was, you know, kind of, and that's a thing, you know, so he's right. It's just a weird thing, but it's not always.
It was so weird hearing them all agree on that.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah, it is different for us. You know, we can't buy houses and we also need an Instagram following.
Yeah. And like you said, to your friend's point, we're no longer able to go walk into rooms and meet people and talk to people and have that energy exchange, you know. He is right. You know, they get to see what you're about you know, and you get to, and they, so now people are just looking at your resume online, your headshots, your IMDb, and you know, what follower, how many followers you have and all that stuff. There's all sorts of other, you know, things that they're gauging, you know, as to how viable you are for a certain part. I think maybe as opposed to just the way it used to be when you'd go in and you'd audition, you'd meet these people and it would be based on what you did in the room, hopefully, you know,
yeah,
so it's a different time for sure.
So what was pursuing this industry like for you? Like you went to acting school and then have you been pursuing it consistently your whole life? Or did you have times where you left the industry, you came back?
You know, when I got to Los Angeles, all I wanted to do was work professionally. And so
how old were you?
I was 21, I think, 20 or 21. Okay. I had done 2 years at a junior college in Carlsbad, and me and a buddy of mine from high school, he's my writing partner, he's still one of my closest friends. We were just doing play after play after play. We were just taking theater courses and stuff. And he said, man, we're spinning our wheels. Let's go up to LA. So we went up to LA and he was the one that said, let's go audition for the Stella Adler. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know who she was, you know? And so I said, sure. You know, any place where we can be around other actors and where we can be working, where we can be doing scenes, doing plays, let's go do it. And all we wanted to do was, you know, was find, get agents, you know, and get somebody making phone calls for you and get you out there. And we were surrounded by a bunch of people who were the same way. It was a really, it was a good bunch, you know. When I think about the actors that came out of that that group, and there were a lot of successful actors, a lot of working actors, came out of that you know, that generation from 89 to about 92, you know, and a bunch of them I'm still in touch with, but we did go after it pretty hard. I think you have to go after it. You have to be pretty disciplined. And you have to go after it. The rules are different. I was telling somebody, I got my first agent. My girlfriend at the time said, hey, I'm going to go audition for this agent. You want to come do a scene with me? We actually went in and did a scene, you know, from a play. And they signed us both. You know, you can't do that anymore. You can't go in with a freaking scene. They want to see, you know, they want to see what you've got. They want to see They want to see you on you know, on film, or they want to see you real, you know. So it's different. But to answer your question, you know, there were times when I, you know, I did pull back a little bit when I had kids. You know, it was that, because that was a huge adjustment for me. I was still working, but I wasn't going as hardcore as I normally did, because I was just adjusting to the whole fatherhood thing, you know. And I always say that Stella warned us about that. Stella said, listen, have sex with them, but don't have kids with them. Don't be stupid. You're here to be an actor. And if the minute you have kids, you know, it's going to get in the way of what you're doing. And she was right. I would never trade it for a minute. My kids are awesome, but it does, you know, it definitely, you know, slows you down a little bit, you know, to a certain extent. So life does slow you down, but if you enjoy it, if you enjoy being on stage, if you enjoy working on, you know, working with other actors on camera or wherever, you'll just keep gravitating towards it, you know, and you'll keep moving in the right direction, I think. And I think that's pretty much what I did.
What is it like to be in this industry and have, like, be able to maintain, like, your friendships and your relationship? Like, is it impossible? Like, I don't even want to ask it like that, but you know what I mean?
You're asking the wrong guy. I'm divorced, man. I don't know. I don't know how to do that, clearly.
You and half of America. Okay, that's not specific to actors. Let's be real. Yeah. My mom's married and divorced 3 times. She's an ice cream woman. Get in line, Rick.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I think that the key is, you know, you have to be happy and feel fulfilled. And the people around you, you hopefully are surrounded by other people who are happy and fulfilled, you know. But it's yeah, I mean, I don't know that. I don't know the secret of that, you know, because again, it's just all I know is what, you know, what really makes me tick is my family, my kids, my brothers and sisters, my friends, and working, you know, and that's when I'm my happiest. You know, yeah. And that's the American dream to me. That's just happiness in what you do. You know, if you feel fulfilled in what you do, you're so lucky. And I always say that to students at the Stella. I say, you know, guys, if this works for you, you're gonna get how lucky you are, because almost every show I've ever worked on, Dexter, all the NCIS shows, I was on a show in Canada for 3 years. FBI show there. I was surrounded by people who were grateful. They got it. Mm-hmm. They understood. I always say, for one asshole that you'll run into, there are 10 grateful, excellent, wonderfully creative human beings that you'll work with. That for me is the ratio. So that's a great ratio if you think about it.
It's phenomenal. yeah, I was going to say, when I was in New York, I was pursuing dance. I was a commercial hip hop mm-hmm. dancer. That was my thing. Like, it was dance, 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 period. Like, from my teens to just whatever I could think of. And so I grew up a lot around dancers. I've never had conversations so deep, felt so seen, felt so heard, such high levels of empathy as I have with actors. Like, I know Hollywood gets a bad rap, but I actually really like it there. Even in my times when I would sometimes bartend there, like, because I still, like, pick up gigs here and there, the best conversations I've ever had were with actors to this day. And even my best friends, like, before I had an affinity towards film, or I, you know, came to terms with it, they were also actors. Mm-hmm. There's just something about an actor that they're able to tap into this, the deepest crevices of one's mind and heart, and be able to, like, communicate it and connect with it.
Yeah, I agree sometimes, but I think there are actors out there who are full of shit too, you know. I mean, there are. But what I love about this industry, you know, creatively, when you work on a set, you know, the gaffer, the makeup crew, the continuity person, the grips, there are so many artists amongst those. A lot of them are musicians and writers and painters, you know. It's such a freaking amazing creative soup that you're in, you know. And you're right, you know, actors, for the most part, and the actors that I really love, and the people that I've had long relationships with, they're people studiers, you know. They're they're aware and they listen and they're quite present, you know, so they're interesting people to talk to, you know, they don't have their heads up their ass too far, you know, and that's been my experience. Really good actors are really present people because, you know, they're studying, you know, they're watching and they listen.
And they're curious.
Emotionally curious, intellectually curious. They're interesting people for that reason, because their eyes and their ears are open.
Yeah. What has been like a challenge for you in this industry? If you had to name one, some challenge that you had to kind of work through.
Being an older white guy, you know, getting work now, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, life's a challenge. You know how it is. Things come up. But yeah, I don't know. I think just keeping things up to date, headshots and doing all that stuff, I'm horrible at. You have to be really good at it. You know, it's important.
I hate the bitch word.
It is. It just sucks.
Even with my podcast, I'm like, if I could have hired a personal assistant and editor, if I had the money for it, I'd be so much happier. But I am all those things.
Yeah, you have to do everything. And look, that's the way it is. At some point for you, you hopefully you'll have tech people handling all that stuff for you, and you'll just be doing this, you know. So, but yeah, just that grunt work that you have to do to keep, you know, just to keep the, you know, keep that fire lit underneath you, you know, and so people, you know, continue to consider you viable.
Yeah, it's hard to do sometimes. That's a good piece of advice. It's the same in dance too. I remember choreographers, as they would get older, they would say like, this is how you stay relevant. This is what I do to stay relevant. It's a thing that's true across all disciplines. Do you have a final piece of advice for anyone, I want to say, who's new to the industry or just in it? Any advice you'd like to give?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying this to some actors today, you know, again, when we were talking about outreach, you need to be, you want to be around people who are happy to be doing what they're doing and are interested in doing what they're doing and aren't too sort of distracted by partying and other things that can kind of come in. I mean, this business attracts a lot of young people, you know. But I remember advice I got from one of my acting teachers at the Stella. He reminded me that all of us, he said, remember, this town is littered with the dead bodies of lazy actors, you know? And I always thought about that, and he was right, you know? So I would say to any actor, wherever you study, find some place, find a class, whatever it is, whatever method, whatever technique it is, some place where you feel safe to be creative and where you're surrounded by other people that you have respect for and who respect you, and stay there and keep working. Because like I said to you earlier, this is ultimately a confidence game. And if you feel confident, you'll deliver. You'll develop your technique. You'll develop that operating system, and you'll be able to deliver whatever the part is, whether it's comedy, whether you're playing a serial killer or whatever script is handed to you, you'll have a game plan for, and you'll feel 7 foot tall.
Yeah, get those hours.
Yeah, so that'd be my advice. But again, and then also just as important, have fun, have fun, have fun. If you don't have fun, if you're not enjoying doing this, go do something else, you know. But I don't see how you can't not enjoy it. I just think it's just so much fun. Like I said, when I was a kid watching, you know, Montgomery Clift and you know, all these amazing actors, you know, in these amazing movies, Steve McQueen and The Great Escape, you know, and it just looked like so much fun, and it is. So if it continues to be fun, you're golden.
Yeah, if you can't find joy in the process, you're fucked.
Right.
That goes for literally everything.
Right.
Rick, thank you so, so much for coming. I really can't thank you enough.
No worries. Aisha, you're so welcome. Thank you for talking to me. I hope that some of this was of some use to you and anybody who listens to this.
And that's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you for tuning in. Please share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating if you gain anything at all from today's podcast. And we look forward to having you back next time.